Okay, I want to thank the organizer for this opportunity. Actually, it's been very interesting to me. So I was asked to kind of describe a little bit of how numerical activity comes and tries to play a role in general computing and what we understand. And for that, I would like to perhaps go back and do some historical revision, as well as connecting with some current results or recent results that kind of motivate or describe what is it that the power of computational simulation is allowing us to do. And I mean, just I'd like to start with a quote. This is a quote by Matt Chopwick from the ABC. It used to be that only weak enough people went into numerics, because the attitude was essentially, well, if you think hard enough, you're smart enough, you don't really need a computer. But Matt has always been adding this kind of point that, well, with the right resources, you can simulate scenarios that you really don't have a good intuition to even begin to think through. And then this might not only lead you to a solution, but also opening up new questions that will be important to think again, both numerically or analytically. And I'll show, hopefully, some examples of those. Because the kind of the realm of computational simulations are very expensive. And I would say that if you can do the problem with anything but a computer, you should. I mean, the computer should be your last resort. But unfortunately, or fortunately, general relativity has plenty of interesting problems where it is, in some sense, your only resort. And we're thinking in scenarios where the compaction of some, say, matter source or energy source with respect to whatever its typical length scale is of order 1 or 0.5 or so. Velocities are very large. And introducing symmetries into the problem basically kills the effect. Because we know, for instance, if we try to do any studies in spherical symmetry in four dimensions, then we kill gravitational waves. And there goes essentially some of the most interesting things we may want to learn from. And so there are scenarios where we either need to solve the answers, the questions in full generality, or even the imposition of some symmetries still leave us with a problem that is not tractable with any of the means we already know. So some of the overarching questions in this camp is, well, trying to explain gravitational waves and the connection with the behavior of the source, and this is related to what Cliff described yesterday, in the context of gravitational wave astronomy. We'd like to understand space and structure in some perhaps very interesting scenarios. We might want to explore conjectures, and I'll show you one in the second part of the talk. And more importantly, ultimately, we have to remember that any numerical simulation provides one answer. So it's not very exhaustive. So we should then take the numerical simulations to provide sufficient input to then try to go back at some problems and then use analytical understanding to try to then come up with a complete picture. And again, I'll show you one example of that. And hopefully, as I said, uncover surprises along the way. So I should perhaps take one step back and basically tell you what we do typically when we try to approach a problem numerically. Well, the first thing is just to kind of undo all of Einstein's hard work in trying to write a covariant theory. We have to kind of break it up. We need an initial value problem. We need to have a notion of some initial state, as Linares was saying, and then try to understand the evolution to the future. That brings us to the problem of formulations. There are many ways of writing as equations in an initial value problem way. Linares alluded to that double characteristic approach where you foliate your space-time with a sequence of non-hypersurfaces. The most prevalent approach is that of the Cauchy approach, where you foliate your space-time with a sequence of space-like hypersurfaces, and there are all sorts of combinations thereof. Once you make a particular choice, and that choice might limit what type of problems you may be able to look at with a particular formulation, you have to ensure that the problem is well-defined, both with respect to the equations that you write and the boundary conditions, the initial conditions you define. But also ensure the best possible case for a numerical simulation, that is to say, to have a system that is symmetric or strongly hyperbolic, which allows a much easier route to trust the problem is well posed. With that, you discretize your equation because computers are good to solving algebraic problems. So you need to introduce some discrete length in your problem. So now we turn the continuous problem into a discrete problem. And hopefully, as h goes to zero, as this discretization lane gets sent to zero by increasing your resolution, you recover the continuum problem. And there are ways to do this rigorously and check that you're actually doing so. We also need to recognize, and this was instrumental in kind of the breakthrough of numerical relativity is to recognize that discrete equations that one ends up solving once you've gone to these three points are not as Einstein equations anymore, are an approximation of Einstein equations. There is no reason a priori to think that they would behave in the right way. And so we have learned how to modify the discrete equations in a way that when you take this limit, the h going to zero limit, you recover Einstein's equation. But if you start, say, off the constrained surface, they are driven back in to the constrained surface already at an analytical level. So that has been a major input in what allowed us to kind of go through all of the problems that we were having prior to the year 2000. We have to have some way to avoid singular regions, either through excision of the black. If we got a black hole, we know inside there will be singular regions, or at least the gradients will just be incredibly large, and we have to do something with it. So by either using particular slicing or slicing that region and making use of the fact that nothing interior of the black hole should be able to affect the exterior, and if we're only interested in the exterior of the space-time, then that should be enough. At least an idea that Bill suggested in the mid-80s. And of course, ultimately, you have to implement all this in a sufficiently powerful computational infrastructure, which involves both software and hardware, and then go through. So with a bit of revisionism, I would say that arguably, prior to the 1990s, there were only two examples, or two key examples, that show the power of computation. One was the head-on collisions of black holes that Cliff alluded to, and the critical phenomenon in general relativity inspired by Chopra. And this was kind of a key, this is kind of the two ends of the spectra. Here was a very practical problem that we wanted to get an answer of. And this was an interesting question that Matt was going after and actually raised all sort of new and interesting behavior that was perhaps not expected in general relativity. Because, of course, things changed rapidly from 2005 onwards. Between 1990s and the year 2000s or so, there was the interest in the field changed perhaps too rapidly in trying to obtain gravitational waves in the more complex scenarios. And that was way ahead of its time, just because the computational resources were not there yet. And so there were lots of failures, but we learned quite a bit from that time. So it's with a numerical simulation, it's very hard to describe what you see. I mean, as you have a collection of numbers, and then from that you have to try to extract the physics. So I'll just show you examples by moving. So first, we also have a problem. Well, we know that the gravity is encoded in the gravitational field and the geometry, and then how do we extract the information there to visualize what's going on? So Cliff already told us. So this is an example of two black holes. They're sufficiently far apart, but not so far that a numeric post-Newtonian approximation can be used to explain what is really going on, because the velocities are going to be are getting close to the speed of a sizable fraction of the speed of light. And of course, we started with black holes already, so the gravitational field there is extremely strong. So the intuition we have is that for a very long time, we're going to be able to use this post-Newtonian approximation, but at some time, we need to switch to the full numerical simulation. So this is an example of a simulation that takes about a month of continuous running on a supercomputer, using about 100 processors, both all working in unison, solving Einstein's equations. And you start with a particular configuration that is quasi-circular. Remember, gravitational waves reduce eccentricity very efficiently, so we expect that the majority of binary mergers will be given by zero-eccentric regimes once they get close enough. So what this movie is going to show you is essentially the lapse function. So we're trying to measure, we have some idea of how much the redshift is near the black holes or in the close region to these highly curved regions of space-time, and asymptotically this goes to one. So I'll just play the movie and describe a few things. So here you see these objects going around each other. As this dynamics goes along, we're extracting gravitational waves at far distances, and then try to link that behavior that we observe with this, and then at some point they merge, and then you see, you can check at late time through different calculations, through different quantities computed, how close this is approximated by a pair of black holes. before I discuss that, let me just show you the gravitational waves. So you know that the only way to rigorously define gravitational waves is at functional infinity. But given that you have access to the full spacetime, you can actually compute the same quantities. So here is just one component, the appropriate component of the Bayer tensor. And we're tracking the waveforms really far out, but we're just zooming in to see what we have in here. So initially, you're going to see that thing. So that this is some initial burst of gravitational waves, which is there just because we are setting up an initial configuration that had the black holes at exactly a circular trajectory. Of course, we know that that's not physical because the spacetime is actually radiating energy, so there should have been built in the initial data some amount of gravitational waves that are coming out. For simplicity, that's not built in, so you have this burst of garbage radiation, in, as we call it. Oops, sorry. But then after that instance goes through, then you're going to see the true physics. So you'll see now the black holes around each other. You begin to see the gravitational waves that are truly produced by the physics of the binary getting closer and closer. The orbit tightens as gravitational waves carry angular momentum from the system. And then eventually, you're going to get the maximum radiation, the black holes merge, and then it's going to go quiescent by bringing itself down. And then at some point, you're going to see the numerical error breaking in. So this was a picture in the early 1990s, so a head-on collision of two black holes. This is kind of the gravitational waves that you will measure at far distances. You can, once you have the full spacetime, trace not geodesics backwards in the past and find out what region of the spacetime is inaccessible by these far observers, and for that, obtain the familiar pair of plant pictures that you can see also in George and Stephen's book. Fast forward 15 years or 20 years, and this is what we can do now for a binary. So this burst of radiation is the one I told you before that was unphysical, so if you ignore that, then you have this very slowly kind of chirping waveform that which you even heard sound effects from Cliff. And then at some point you get to be in the very nonlinear regime. But this situation is very, very mildly different from what you had before. So if someone had put a gun in your head, you knew what to expect from here from positronia, and you knew at daytime what to expect from quasi normal mode ringing from a black hole. And if you smoothly merge one with the other one, you pretty much would have obtained what numerical relativity actually shown. But with that, again, you have the full spacetime, and you can obtain now what the pair of plants would look like. This is for a case that there is mass ratio of 1 to 3 in the black holes. And again, you have the structure of the two legs of the pair of plants coming to air here. And then as you wait, this black hole here, this event horizon here, gets closer and closer to that of the Kerr black hole. So the main take-home messages from a practical point of view is that the simulations are showing that the dynamics of this binary, as it goes kind of quasi-transitioning from the very quasi-adiabatical regime, where there is a gradual increase in the frequency of the orbit as they get closer and closer to merger, then there is some strongly nonlinear regime, but that strongly nonlinear regime is kind of similar to what you had before, but on steroids in some sense. Then they get close enough, the black holes plunge with each other, and then they radiate their excess here if you want to go to a pair of black hole. More importantly, you can now get numbers for gravitational wave astronomy and for just trying to understand the astrophysics of the problem. And then you realize that about 5% of the total initial mass of the system is radiated. About 5% of the final angular momentum that the system has when the black when these holes are close enough. And then, of course, depending on how you tune the system, you can increase those numbers, but not by a whole lot more. You can estimate what is the amount of gravitational wave energy that comes out, at least of the order of, and then scaling everything as if the binary had 10 to the 6 solar masses, just because. So 10 to the 58 ergs times this conversion factor, which scales with the total mass of the system, in about 100 seconds for a 10 to the 6 solar mass binary. Because you divide energy by time, you get a luminosity, and that's 10 to the 23 times the luminosity of the sun. So a single gravitational wave event outshines the rest of the universe combined on the electromagnetic side. Interestingly, then people started seeing new things. even though from Posidonians you did know that if the system merged and there was an asymmetric emission of gravitational waves, because the center of mass in general relativity has to be conserved, the final black hole would be recoding in the opposite direction. But people have been able to find out configurations that are that show this final black hole moving at about even 8,000 kilometers per second. And that's very relevant because that is too large a velocity for a black hole merger, say in a galaxy scenario, to leave a black hole at the center of the galaxy. This actually would be a black hole that would have been kicked out of the galaxy altogether. And so then you turned out into asking questions to nature. Either somehow nature does not prevent this prevents these configurations from taking place, or we should have evidence of rogue black holes in the universe, which we don't have. So typically, if you do say nature has a way to not align the system to have these very strong peaks, then you get more to the 100 kilometers per second, so that's very fine. But still, the energy, the mechanical energy you're releasing in the environment is so large that you could be triggering electromagnetic counterparts to these gravitational waves in an important manner. And that's one of the most important goals of the new era of gravitational wave astronomy. So the current effort is being divided in several fronts. So there's a group of people that are constructing accurate waveform templates for using data analysis. The data analysis enterprise requires a whole bunch of templates which are going to be used to dig out the signal from the noise. I mean, you heard Cliff's sound bites, the noise of the detector actually is stronger than the signal itself, and you have to go and dig it up. People are studying the astrophysical implications, both in the supermassive black hole merger, but also in the stellar mass case. But there is quite a bit of interest nowadays in the non-vacuum binaries, because the moment you put matter in the game, you can trigger both gravitational waves and electromagnetic counterparts and both neutrino productions in the system. There is some work in gravitational waves in alternative theory of gravities, and just try to assess how much LIGO might be able to pick it up. And the password in the community is multi-messenger astronomy, trying to see how much you can get from a given system. So I'll just show you some examples here. So this is an example, again, the same two black holes that we could have been discussing before, but now the black holes are interacting with the plasma. As if they interact with the plasma, they may be able to essentially power a quasar, but actually two quasars, two AGNs, they're going around each other. As they do that, the plasma taps the kinetic energy or the unrotational energy of the black hole, and that powers these strong jets. These black holes come together, there's going to be very strong bursts of radiation, and then it gives rise to a curved black hole that goes back to the blunt force knife that was alluded by Paul on his talk. This is an example of a merger of two neutron stars. So again, when you're very, very far apart, the gravitational waves are exactly the same as you would expect for binary black hole mergers, because internal structure plays no role. But when they get close enough, the internal structure of the neutron star does play a major role. And how that impacts gravitational waves will tell us about the equation of state of the neutron star. And this is an example of three binaries have exactly the same masses, the components, but the equation of state makes the radius of the star be slightly different. And even though the gravitational waves are exactly the same early on, once the merger takes place, there are significant differences that could be picked up by LIGO or actually some improvements of it. And this is just so that you see a little bit of the complications of this simulation. This is a black hole. And the neutron star, you're going to see a square region cut out. That's the excision of the singularity. So this is a region inside the black hole. And of course, we know black holes are square. We can take a square out. Now, the joke is, because we're using a Cartesian grid, that's the most natural thing to use. But the black hole is just pictured as a sphere that's outside of it. But here, you're going to see all the kind of meshes going around, because you want to do this simulations as efficient as possible, so you put more resolution where you need it, and far out you don't. And this is all going on automatically. There is no babysitting in this simulation of how the grids have to adjust themselves.
Sorry, what were you plotting there?
So here, let me just play it again, is a density. So we're just showing the density of the star in a logarithmic color map, so you begin to see tidal effects stripping the outer layers of the star. And then at some point, those are being accreted by the black hole. And then these tidal tails are going to be part of the accretion disk that will be surrounding the black hole and may play an important role or should play a crucial role in powering the gamma ray burst. So the interesting thing is once you gather enough information, you can actually see that at least qualitatively, the features of the waveforms in all these systems can be understood in simple terms by using a little bit of Newtonian intuition coupled with the intuition that we know, or we have gained the understanding of particle trajectories around, say, a Kerr black hole. You can actually build all that in affecting models of the system that actually does a pretty good job. And the reason for that is we've seen that gravitational waves are essentially a very smooth, they have a very smooth transition from the prior to the very nonlinear regime to the nonlinear regime and afterwards. Interestingly, for kind of more fundamental questions, there are no extremal scenarios arising, i.e., in this binary merger, especially, say, of the binary Eusenstar mergers. Of course, we don't know how to define a local concept of angular momentum and a well-defined concept in this regime of how much mass is there, but if we just compute the baryonic contribution to the mass of the system, the baryonic contribution to the angular momentum of the system, we can identify regions in this merged object that do not satisfy the Kerr bound. And yet you see the system hanging in there, not forming a black hole, there is no trapped surface that you can find, and just losing angular momentum. And once this gets below the Kerr bound, then the black hole forms. So it does seem that the space-time is really reacting or trying to prevent any pathology from that point of view. And the late time behavior, once you wait long enough, you can compare with what you would expect the space-time be like if you were close to a Kerr solution, and you actually get. And from all possible ways, you can obtain the behavior of Poissonian loads, disencode not only the mass, but the angular momentum parameter of the system, and it agrees very well with what you expect. Same thing about the horizon structure and the asymptotic structure of the system. But now let me change gears and then just go kind of really much in a tangent, abandoning kind of the practical applications, but just going into kind of the fun side of things, and then just try to go to a higher dimensional gravitational setup. So one could ask why is it we would like to or care about higher dimensions? So one is just from a fundamental level. We can understand, or we have an appreciation that the equal four gravity is very special. Why? Because, well, first, we know even from Newtonian theory, there are no stable circular orbits if we were to live in a five-dimensional space-time. We also know that we can write down solutions of rotating black holes that have no upper bound. So you can have arbitrarily fast-spinning black holes without any pathology in the space-time. And not only that, we have the same symmetries, we do have no uniqueness. So we can have a black hole that has angular momentum, and we can obtain another space-time that has exactly the same angular momentum, exactly the same charges at infinity, same mass, same angular momentum, but topologically the black hole is completely different. So people have written solutions that show that come with the names of black spheres or black spinning black holes. We have black rings, so these are torus that are going around. We have black Saturns, so it's the torus with a black hole in the middle, and all those asymptotically behave exactly the same way. And so uniqueness goes out the window. So just that allows some extra richness in the problems, and then try to dig out for interesting connections. Of course, if you actually, I think it's a bad word perhaps in this context or in this community, but if string theory were to provide the correct path of quantum gravity theory, then there are issues there as well, because naturally string theory wants to call for higher dimensions. And recently, due to this ADS-CFT, there's a lot of interest of trying to understand gravity in five dimensions, but I'm not going to go here. Let's imagine we just stay at that point. And why? Because we're going to see something very interesting. There's a system of, as I mentioned, there's more than one black hole for even some particular, even simple scenarios. And so one of them is this sort of black string. So imagine that the extra dimension, so take Schwarzschild, and imagine there is an extra dimension, and that dimension we're going to make it periodic for simplicity. And we can ask how many very symmetric situations we can think of for a given amount of mass that we can write. And there are these two solutions. One is the so-called Tangerlini black hole. This is the analog of Schwarzschild black hole in one extra dimension. But the other one is a black string, which, and it, if we make a cut here, it's exactly the same as black, as Schwarzschild, but we actually stack them up in the extra dimension and create these things. So this is called the black string. So we can now ask, are these black holes thick? And so we can just at least, in a very kind of simple-minded physics point of view questions, we can say, well, if you perturb the black hole, and we analyze the linearized stability of the problem, do black perturbations decay away or not? And so in this case, they do. But in this case, if this extra dimension is large enough, they don't. And this is something that Gregor Laflamme did in the mid-90s. And this is the spectra of the rate of, say, exponential blow-up of these perturbations. So if the black string is too short, or the extra dimension is short enough, then this curve grows into the negative side, and then any perturbation will be stable, it will decay away. But if the black string or the extra dimension is sufficiently long, then you actually are in this regime, and this could trigger actually exponentially growing modes. If you add to that another observation, you say, well, given, suppose you have an amount of mass, a fixed amount of mass in the system, and you want to distribute it on the spherical black hole or on the black string black hole, you can ask which one would have more entropy. And it turns out that if this one is long enough, this one has less entropy than that one. So the speculation was that this, as you prepare this one, eventually we want to try to maximize its entropy, and to do that, it will just change its topology, it will pinch off and give rise to a single black hole. But of course, if it's going to do that, it's going to have to do something like this, which is, would be like turn George's picture upside down. But we know that this cannot happen, because that would violate cosmic censorship, the weak cosmic censorship of this. And so it's an interesting question to then try to understand if that's what happens. So I'll show you what happens again. We're going to do a numerical simulation of the system. What I'm going to show first is the very same thing that which I showed before, this behavior of the lapse function of this proper time. Actually, it's is the inverse of what I showed before, but it's conveying essentially the same information. So this is an observer at infinity, what it will see. So you perturb it, begins to oscillate a little bit, then it's going to begin to develop some extra structure here, but very quickly we'll do something here, and here, and there, and all that happens extremely fast. So let me slow down and show you what happens near this object. So again, this is the black string, this is the extra dimensions, this is the radial direction. We're going to see how this perturbation begins to modify the structure. Oops, sorry. So, let me stop. Sorry. So I'm pausing it here. So what has happened is these perturbations in some places is making this the radius of some regions to expand. It's making another one shrink. The second law of the area growth law has to still stay put, still be satisfied. So this one is compensating for the shrinking of this one, but also the string is getting longer in this direction, so that you, at any given time, the rate of change of the area is positive, or at least not negative. But once you get to this regime, this piece is also unstable to exactly the same behavior, and you're going to see this going on continue. So that is sufficiently thin and long for an instability to show up, and then you're going to see that one's happening there. But the same thing happens now to the side. You're going to see another satellite forming, and this process will continue. So this is a simulation that took about 2 months, and we saw four generations of this going on. I'll show you a zoom in on that. So now this movie will just concentrate on the piece, and it will just go in there to show this more clearly. And now you see the second satellite, and it will go and do another zoom in. You see the third one, and then you're going to see a fourth one going there, at which point the size in here is about 50 times smaller than the initial time size that it started with. Furthermore, you can compute some curvature invariants and see how these different satellites are showing structure. So this is the first one, that's the second one, this is the third one, and that's the fourth one. And you see these two men, they look very much the same. So the system is behaving self-similarly. We can do the calculation of the area, so the area of the total area of the string actually grows as it should, but asymptotically, it's going to what you would have predicted if the black hole really wanted to maximize its entropy by doing this topology change and going, putting everything on this spherical black hole. So it's going in that direction. But more importantly, you can calculate if this process continued, at what point it would shrink to zero size. And that time is a finite time. So an observer will actually see this happen in finite time. Let me just, in virtue of time, we'll just not say that. But more interestingly, once you see this, you actually recall there is a fluid behavior that has the same qualitative features. And this is called the rated plateau instability, that you can actually play around with your tap water. So if you have a very thin stream of fluid, it's unstable to actually break off. And so this is the same, the analog plot for fluid perturbations as opposed to the gravitational ones in that scenario where you have a very thin stream of fluid and you could entertain higher dimensions in the fluid and implication. These are experimental features of many different satellites coming formed as instability kicked in. So you can now look at the analogy and compare. So in fluids, people have understood that the solution, as this pinch off is occurring, is actually self-similar. And there is a prediction, there is actually a theory behind showing how the self-similar dependency would be on time and the radius of this stream of fluid. And you can obtain, for instance, how the size would vary with respect to variations in time as you approach the pinching off time, and you get this expression. And this is actually realized in the simulations within 10-20%, what we can actually capture numerically. So we can actually speculate a little bit here. One obvious outcome of this is that, well, at least in higher dimensions, cosmic censorship seems to be much more easily violated than in D equal 4. And there are many, many black holes that have instabilities associated to this one. So there are many black holes of these ones I told you about that have regimes that will be described quite well by a black string. And since we know those are unstable, all these black holes should be unstable as well. But now we can say, well, what might happen? So you can understand as how the pinch off is going to happen. So the neck shrinks to zero size. You can estimate would be the mass that pinching off naked singularity that would arise from how much effective mass would have, and it has an effective zero mass. The solution is going back, it's the same as the one that Choplik found in the D equal 4 case, just at that region. But if we make the analogy to the fluid case, so in the fluid we can use Navier-Stokes equation to actually describe, or the fluid equation, to describe the pinching off case. So at some point, the equation ceases to make any sense because we're going to be probing scales where the molecular structure of the fluid would actually arise, and the equations would not make any sense anymore. But if you have played with bubbles at any point, you know that, well, even though you couldn't resolve the pinching off, you know what's going to happen. It pinches off and then it creates this bubble and then it smooths out. And after the pinch offs are taking place, you can again use the same equations to describe how the bubble would behave. So if the same thing were to happen in the gravitational case, well, even though we need quantum gravity to say exactly what the details of the behavior would be, we expect that at some point, again, classical gravity should be applicable, and we don't expect anything strange to happen. But of course, that remains to be seen. Of course, there's a lot more going on. There's a lot of work in the astrophysical connection, as I said. There has been work in black hole evaporation. This is something that Franz Pretorius, Alois Apsiker, and Fethi Ramazanoglu did not too long ago. There are applications of numerical simulations in cosmology, exploring things like the bubble collisions in the multiverse, as George described or mentioned the other day, periodic scenarios. Quite a bit of work in high dimensional gravity is starting, most of that motivated by the application of ADS-CFT. And again, just asking questions with the full power of the equations actually incorporated has also shown surprises recently For instance, the fact that the gravitational field in the right regime can show a turbulent behavior, give rise to fractal structure of horizons, etc. So it's just an example or a set of examples where the numerical simulations have given us a way into the full nonlinear context of the theory, and both for practical applications and for interesting side questions, it's a very interesting way to go. So with that, I'll stop.
Let's take a 22-minute break and meet again at 11:05.
Worry what the Gordon Commission was.
There are definitely conditions, and the results are very sensitive to the Gordon
gauges.
Yes. So these chosen things which are circling out, what are they? Those things which are circling out to that?
Those are pure. That's like psi 4.
That's
psi
4, okay.
The drift is rolling.
That's
a
very
unlike me.
No, of course they won't.
Oh, yeah, you felt guilty. You know what? Guilty? No. So was this not the reason you didn't sleep?
No, I think
you probably should have felt guilty. You were really guilty that you didn't feel guilty.
Oh, okay. That may be it, yeah.
You didn't get any more here in the middle of the night? Oh, you look out.
No, I just felt guilty that I treated Cliff so badly.
Cliff?
Oh, okay.